20 minutes later, after a nightmare ride through the streets of D.C., dodging crashed cars and cabs and stunned tourists and wild-eyed government employees roving the streets, Brad was sitting in the Situation Room of the White House, located securely underground in the heart of the historic building. He rubbed the bridge of his nose with his thumb and forefinger and tried to ignore the agitated thumping of the Secretary of Agriculture's designer pen on her White House notepad. His eyes felt gritty and his chest hurt. His irritation at the late hour and the command performance meeting had given way to cold terror once he saw the streets of the city. Whatever happened out there in L.A. wasn't a dream or an isolated incident. D.C. clearly had been hit, too. Hit hard if what Brad had seen on the way here was any indication. Now, as reports poured into this top-level meeting from around the country, Brad was forced to accept that the phenomenon was nationwide. His assistant was still trying to reach Christine. She had promised to send him word as soon as she got through to his wife. Brad was praying on a moment-by-moment basis whenever he could take his attention off the meeting going on around him.
"Please, Lord,"
he prayed,
"let them be safe."
Ruthlessly, he ignored the voice in his head that told him that since he hadn't spoken to the Almighty in years, the Almighty might not have time for him right now. Christine was a devout, loving, God-fearing woman. God would have time for Christine, Brad told himself. Brad was jerked from his reverie when the president brought his fist down on the polished table and roared at his hastily assembled cabinet and staff. He swore as he looked sharply at Edward Layton, the Secretary of Defense.
"Why didn't we know this was coming, Ed?"
President Gerald Fitzhugh said.
"Just what has the CIA been doing for the past 10 years that we didn't know this was coming?"
Layton cleared his throat.
"We don't know if we've been attacked yet, Mr. President,"
he said.
"I think we should reserve judgment."
"Of course we've been attacked,"
the president barked.
"We're missing millions of people. The phone lines are down. Airplanes are falling out of the sky. We can't determine who's minding the shop at 90% of our nuclear power facilities. And we can't get a definitive answer on who's watching our missile sites, not to mention the collateral damage to civilians. Did you look out the windows on your way here? It's a nightmare out there. If we haven't been attacked, what in the blazes do you think has happened?"
No one around the large table spoke. The president surged from his chair with a dark curse and began to pace. Charlie Swelder, chief policy advisor to the president and the man widely believed to have orchestrated Fitzhugh's rise to power, leaned back in his chair. The chair groaned, drawing the attention of the other occupants in the room. In his characteristically steely tone, Swelder told the secretary,
"Someone dropped the ball, Ed. Whether it's your intel or the CIA, somebody dropped the ball."
Ed Layton scowled.
"I'm not taking the fall for this."
"Then find someone who is," Swelder said flatly.
The ultimatum unleashed the barely contained tension in the room. As the president looked out the window, staring at the blazing skyline, Brad glanced at the faces of the group around the table. 3 cabinet members were missing, though the Secretary of Labor's and the Secretary of Education's absences were notable in light of... Chapter 2. Crystal City, Virginia. Local time, 2:30 a.m. The Reverend Marcus Dumont stared out the plate glass window of the conference room. Even in the darkness, the devastation in the nation's capital was obvious. Everywhere, the dull glow of red and blue emergency lights cut through a haze of smoke and debris that hung in the air, obscuring the thousands of architectural lights that illuminated the city's familiar landmarks. The din of sirens and evacuation horns carried across the Potomac to the relative quiet of Marcus's 11th-story office suite where he stood, watching the scene unfold. The debris of several airliners that had been en route to or from Washington's Reagan National Airport extended from the dark waters in a tangled mass of twisted metal. Marcus could make out the shapes of human corpses floating beside the fuselages. Not since September 11, 2001, had so many fighter jets and military and civilian emergency aircraft cluttered Washington's pristine skyline. From the spires of the National Cathedral to the dome of the U.S. Capitol, Marcus had a panoramic view of the disaster's aftermath. At the Pentagon, every office was lit despite the late hour, and all around him in the large Crystal City business complex, terror and confusion reigned.
he could see the White House in the distance, and there the lights burned also. It was an anomaly these days, since the First Lady had demanded that the outside lights be shut off and the press banished from the White House lawn at 10 p.m. each night. But the President and the staff were up, as they would be, Marcus knew, for the next few days. He had escaped here to the conference room of New Covenant Evangelical Ministries to get away from the incessant ringing of the telephone, the sounds of weeping and horror that carried up and down the halls of the office building, and the guilt, mostly the guilt, because Marcus had the answers. He had had them since he'd received the call at 1:30 a.m. from his frantic media director. The call had come as no surprise. Marcus had been summoned into the office in the small hours of the morning many times. Through the years, there had been any number of national and international crises that demanded prayer support. He had gotten phone calls from U.S. presidents asking for wisdom and counsel. He had sat in emergency meetings with his staff to discuss a non-favorable story about their organization that would break in the morning's papers. He had held prayer vigils for faithful supporters whose lives were slowly ebbing away. Then Marcus had admitted to no one but himself his heart hadn't been in the fervent prayers he had led for the healing hand of God. The death of a wealthy saint usually meant financial health for New Covenant. Marcus had an excellent economic development team that worked regularly with high-dollar donors to ensure New Covenant's place in their estate planning. Perhaps that's why the feeling of guilt he now felt seemed to overshadow any sense of shock at what he was seeing. Nearly everyone was asking the same questions. What had happened an hour ago when nearly a third of the world's population had mysteriously and suddenly vanished? Was it an attack? Had their enemies developed a new and devastating weapon? Who was left, and who was missing, and why? Where were the missing people? What could be done to get them back? While everyone else was asking those questions, Marcus knew without any doubt or hesitation, that as horrible as this all seemed right now, it was only the beginning. God had gathered his faithful. Christians around the globe had vanished, swept up in a massive and dramatic fulfillment of the Lord's promised gathering of his people. Leaving behind all who had rejected the truth of Jesus Christ, the Christians had been taken to their heavenly reward, and the horrible events of the tribulation had begun.